right, we welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We apologize for our delay. We had an emergency with one of our judges in that they lost a family member, and so we've been doing a little shuffling here today. We hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving holiday, however. I'm Justice Terry Livingston. To my left is Justice Lee Gabriel, and to my right is Justice Ann Gardner. And we're happy to have you all with us. We have two cases scheduled for our 9 o'clock docket. I believe everyone has checked in. The first case we'll hear is Estate of Barbara Sloan, cause number 215-198-CV. Arguing for appellant will be Rick Disney, and arguing for appellee will be Sydney T. Lang. No, I'm sorry, Scott Fredericks. Do I have that correct now? Okay. And I understand you have indicated to our clerk that you are seeking and will use your 15 and 5 and your 15 minutes as well. So I think that's all we need to cover right now. And if we'll ask Mr. Disney to begin, please. Thank you. Wait a second, I think we have a question.
I have a question. Excuse me. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was wanting to confirm that the Winton Terrace property that we're talking about was also listed on the inventory appraisal and list of claims as 444. Meaning it was community property.
Yes. And he listed it as community asset.
That's what I meant to confirm, that it was listed on that document, which was filed and approved by the court.
Again, he's not necessarily, and I'm going to get to that as the distinction, but it's not a valuation of Winton Terrace. His obligation is to put the It's the value of Barbara's interest in Winton Terrace that's at issue here. And those are two completely different numbers, as I'm going to explain. The Supreme Court of Texas has said that a homestead right, a constitutionally protected homestead right that Hollis had, the parts have stipulated, is an estate in land. Even though Hollis did not have a half community interest like he thought he did, he did have a homestead interest in Barbara's separate property at Winton Terrace. That homestead right gave him the right to live in that house the rest of his life, regardless of who owns legal title. Hollis's homestead legally is an encumbrance on Barbara's separate property homestead. And the Supreme Court of the United States has said that that homestead as an encumbrance has the effect of reducing the underlying ownership right, that's Barbara, to something akin to a remainder interest. Now, to illustrate the difference on these values, I hope this makes sense. Let's pretend for a second there are two identical houses on Winton Terrace. Barbara owns both of them. They're both separate property. One of them's empty, paid for, unencumbered. The other is her and Hollis's homestead. They're both listed for sale. Let's accept that a willing buyer would pay $444,000 for the first house. It's unencumbered. That's the reasonable price. Would a buyer pay the same amount for the identical house that came with Hollis living in it for the rest of his life? Well, common sense suggests the answer is no.
Wasn't that the decision of the trial judge to make as to what it was worth? And whether that encumbrance, since it wasn't an ownership, devalued the property in any way?
And he said it didn't.
Okay.
He said that the homestead had no effect on the fair market value. And the United States Supreme Court has said a homestead has the effect of reducing the value of the surviving of the deceased spouse's separate property.
In every instance?
I believe so. It's a fundamental concept. A homestead has value. And that's what Judge King did not determine. He said, basically said the value was zero. But if the homestead is an estate in land, by definition it has to have some value. So if it reduces the value of her separate property by some amount, how much? How do we determine what Barbara's interest in Winton Terrace, subject to Hollis's homestead, what's that worth? Because that's what Hollis was required to pay.
So did the issue as to the valuation come up, I guess, during the probate of Hollis's estate?
No. I mean, he thought it was community property. He acted consistent with that. He listed it as a $222,000 on the inventory on the federal estate tax return. He transferred property worth $222,000. He did everything right if, in fact, it was community property. The problem is they didn't look at the deed. They were wrong. The question is a mistake by itself a breach of fiduciary duty?
But what is the impact of him now listing basically twice on two different inventories as to this particular piece of property as community property? Is there no like estoppel on anybody? Because this litigation is going on in 2014, but he died back in 2007?
Well, this issue is breach of fiduciary duty.
Mm-hmm.
This court has held a number of occasions, most recently on the Shelby Sharp case, mm-hmm. that there are three elements, the third of which is you got to have damages to the party to whom the fiduciary duty is owed or a benefit to the one who owes the fiduciary duty. If you don't have that, even if you make a mistake, like you clearly did here, there's no breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, I'm wanting to say, wait a minute, on saying that there clearly was a mistake, because how can it be, and I'll have to admit that I came into this case late, that even though the deed to Mrs. Sloan said, from Ms. McMillan or whoever it was, said it was conveyed to Mrs. Sloan as her sole and separate property, it seems like it's established by the record that all of the money, the funds, the consideration for the property came from community property. The $50,000 loan was community. The $40,000 cash I'll make it a question. The $40,000 cash, and then what was the other? A note for the remainder.
There was another piece of property.
And all of those were community property. Are those not to be taken into consideration as establishing that it was community property?
I took that position initially. Candidly, the way it's sorted out, there are some cases that say if the husband is aware that the wife or the other spouse is taking the property as sole and separate, then he's in essence consented to the use of funds, of community funds, to go turn into something's her separate property.
Does he have a right of reimbursement?
Didn't the party stipulate it was separate property?
No, I raised it, but I'm not appealing.
Okay.
I've acknowledged for the purpose of appeal that it's separate property. Okay, so how do we value the homestead? The answer has been given by the United States Supreme Court. This was a Texas case, United States versus Rogers. In that case, the Supreme Court said that the value of the deceased spouse's separate property is reduced by surviving spouse's homestead. That's exactly what we have here. Now, how do you determine that? Supreme Court went on to explain you use life tables to determine the value of the surviving spouse and the value of the deceased spouse in that property because of the homestead. The parties have stipulated that the life estate value of Paula Sloan as of the date of Barbara was 47.346% of the total. That means that Barbara's interest was 52.654% of the total. Now, applying that analysis to the text, to our case, as we showed in the brief, here's where the math comes in. That means Barbara's interest in Wynton Paris, even though it's separate property, it's subject to his homestead interest, meaning 52.654% of the total is hers. That's the value. That's $233,783.76. Not the $444,000 that Judge King said her interest was worth that he had to pay. So, if we're there and say fair market value was $233,783 and Hollis only paid $222,000, does that mean that Hollis breached his fiduciary duty but not as badly as Judge King thought? There's where the community reimbursement comes in. Judge King ruled correctly that there was a $50,000 community debt, which means that Hollis was entitled to a $25,000 community reimbursement claim against Barbara's estate. So if you take the $233,783, subtract the $25,000 community estate, because he's entitled to that credit, that means that Hollis was legally required to pay fair market value to come up with $208,783.76 in additional compensation, either by money or property. The facts show that he actually transferred to Barbara's estate $222,000. He was legally obligated to do $208,000. He has paid a little bit more. Now, is it kind of dumb luck that it worked out this way? Yeah, it is. He didn't think about this. He didn't use it. But you cannot, I found no cases that say, you did something, so therefore you're not worthy of claiming a homestead. A homestead is a constitutionally protected right. In this case, under our analysis, which the United States Supreme Court has expressly sanctioned and the Texas Supreme Court has quoted with approval the language that we're using, Hollis was required to pay $208,000. He paid $222,000. Therefore, he did not underpay. He did not breach his fiduciary duty. We respectfully ask this court to reverse and render and hold that there was no breach of fiduciary duty in this case.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Disney. Mr. Fredericks.
court said no, that to approve of such conduct would amount to sanctioning self-dealing by an executor. Appellant today asked this court to reverse that holding and say, yes, there's nothing wrong with an executor selling estate property to himself at half the appraised value because of his own possessory homestead right. But appellant has not presented a single authority approving such a sale or even holding that a possessory homestead right has the same economic value as a life estate. To the contrary, the only two opinions that are cited by appellant make it clear that a homestead right and a life estate are not identical. Notably, every time appellant quotes the language from the Texas Supreme Court case of Laster versus First Huntsville Properties, that a homestead right is akin to a life estate and has the effect of reducing the underlying ownership rights, the appellant deletes the introductory clause that begins that sentence. It starts this way, quote, although the homestead estate is not identical to a life estate, and then it goes on to compare the interests. In other words, the only Texas court opinion cited in support of the proposition that homestead rights should be valued exactly like a life estate highlights the fact that a homestead right is not identical to a life estate. Yes, a homestead right shares some features with a life estate, most notably that the holder of a life estate and a homestead right have possessory rights superior to the fee owner. But simply noting, as the court in Laster and the United States Supreme Court does, that these two property interests share some features is far from stating that these property interests have the same economic value. The other case relied upon by appellant is just as clear that a life estate and a possessory homestead right are similar, but not identical. The United States Supreme Court case that Mr. Disney just referred to says this as much. In that case, the court was tasked with deciding whether a provision of the tax code empowered a federal court to order a forced sale of a family home to satisfy a delinquent taxpayer's home indebtedness, where the non-delinquent spouse held a Texas homestead interest in the property. And in conducting its analysis, the court observed that one could analogize between a homestead right, a homestead interest, and a life estate. In the same breath, it noted that such an analogy was hazardous in this area and does some injustice to the nuances present in the Texas homestead statute. And in fact, in that opinion, when it goes on to describe the tax tables, at the beginning of that, it specifically states that they are not addressing that issue, that the issue of how the estate should be valued was not before the United States Supreme Court. So in other words, none of the authorities that are relied upon by the appellant reached the conclusion that they would have this court adopt, that possessory homestead interest and a life estate have exactly the same economic value. To the contrary, there's a very clear distinction between a life estate and a homestead right in real property. A life estate is actually a vested economic interest in real property which can be bought and sold by the life tenant. Whereas a homestead right is simply a legal interest that protects the right of a spouse to live on the property for the rest of his or her life, but cannot be bought or sold. In the course of preparing for today's oral argument, I found a case that is consistent with the cases cited in our brief, but more directly addresses this particular issue that is central to appellant's argument. Specifically, it refutes the appellant's core contention that a homestead interest has the same economic value as a life estate. The opinion is from a 2014 Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it interprets the statements from Laster and Rogers that the appellant relies upon here. The case is, the style of the case is In Re Odes Ho Kim, that is O-D-E-S and H-O and K-I-M, and the citation is 748 F-3rd 647. And notably, the opinion is authored by former Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen. That case arises from a bankruptcy proceeding in which a non-debtor spouse contended that her homestead rights in a Texas residence precluded a forced sale of the property to satisfy the debts of her husband. In this respect, the case is similar to both the issues presented to the Laster Court and the Rogers Court. However, in Ozo Kim, the Kims made the same claim that the appellants make here, and they based their argument on the same rejects the spouse's claim, quotes from both the Laster opinion and the Rogers opinion, and points out that both of those opinions acknowledge that a homestead interest is not the economic equivalent of a life estate. On page 661 of that court's opinion, Justice Owen writes this: "One significant difference between the economic value of a life estate and a homestead in homestead rights is that the former can be alienated, that is, a life estate can be alienated, while the latter cannot. When a spouse no longer possesses the real property that was impressed with homestead rights, the homestead rights in that property cease to exist. A spouse cannot transfer her homestead rights and receive value in exchange. This is not true of a life estate. The assumptions used only for illustrative purposes in Rogers with those tax tables would seem to overvalue homestead rights under Texas law." Justice Owen goes on, this is on page 662 of her opinion: "As already noted, if she, that is the spouse claiming the homestead interest, if she had a life estate in the residence, she would be entitled to sell that life estate for its market value, which might well be calculated using assumptions based on her age and the discount rate. But she cannot sell her homestead rights in the residence."
But doesn't that issue become moot since the parties agreed ahead of time to quite a substantial list of stipulated facts, wherein you all agree as to a valuation for the life estate held by Mr. Hollis?
The stipulation was simply that a life estate, if he owned one, would be calculated by that amount. There was not a stipulation that he actually had a life estate in the property, or that the life estate was actually the way that the valuation of his homestead interest.
So there's no stipulation as to a value for his homestead.
Correct. That is correct. For purposes of presenting that issue to the trial court, the stipulation was, if the trial court were to determine that the value of his homestead interest were the same as a life estate, that was the calculation that the parties agreed should be applied. But that issue was hotly contested, and that's what we're here on today.
And in the Fifth Circuit case, it sounds like, and I haven't read the case, that the court was concerned with whether the entire property could be foreclosed on, or could be foreclosed on, which would include the homestead.
That's right. That's right.
But and here, Mr. Sloan continued to possess the homestead. There was no question of conveying it to someone else.
That's right.
It's just a question of how much should he pay, or should he have paid for the remainder.
That's right. Of course, under Texas homestead law, there are only certain circumstances, very limited circumstances, in which a homestead can be sold or transferred. And so the cases, most of the cases that you look at in this area address, sometimes they're condemnation proceedings or tax proceedings where somebody is claiming, a mortgagee is claiming, that they should be allowed to come and kind of reduce to monetary value the interest that's there. And then it's how much, if at all, should the homestead interest, how do you protect that homestead interest? Does it preclude the forced sale entirely, either under condemnation proceeding or in tax proceeding, or what do you do with the proceeds?
Did the Fifth Circuit hold that it precluded sale entirely, or the forced sale?
The U.S. v. Rogers case states that the tax that it can be foreclosed on for satisfying the tax debt of the non-debtor spouse.
Okay.
So, in fact, in the Fifth Circuit case that I referred to, the Kim case, the court goes on to actually refer to another much older Texas Supreme Court case that was a condemnation proceeding. And that case is Lucas versus Lucas. And that's found at 143 Southwest 1153. And that's a 1912 Texas Supreme Court case. And in that case, the Texas Supreme Court held that a trial court could not partition the proceeds of a condemnation action between the holder of the homestead right and the other heirs of the deceased husband. Rather, the Supreme Court held that the trial court should have instead directed that all of the proceeds from the condemnation be reinvested in a new homestead, thereby protecting the surviving spouse's right to a residence that was protected under the homestead law, but also preserving the full value of that property that was held by the fee owner.
How would you respond to Mr. Disney's argument that the homestead interest clearly affected the value that a willing buyer would pay for the property in question, and therefore Judge King erred in not taking that into consideration?
Well, indeed it would if he had continued to claim the homestead in that property. So if there was a third-party buyer, so here it's all confused because the buyer and the seller are the same person, so they can reach an agreement. But let's say a third party had approached another executor of the estate and wanted to purchase it. Well, the estate under the homestead law, it's not clear that the estate would have even had the power to dispossess Mr. Sloan of the property while he was living on it, short of his voluntary giving waiver or abandonment. That's exactly the point that these cases draw, is that the distinction between a life estate, where he could have sold his interest in it if it were merely a life estate, and he could transfer his right to live in that house to somebody else. He can't sell that right to live in the house to anybody else. He can abandon it, but he doesn't get economic value in exchange for abandoning the value.
His argument is a willing buyer wouldn't pay $444,000 for a house that they're not going to be able to live in until Mr. Sloan dies.
That's exactly right. The issue here is whether Mr. Sloan should be the beneficiary of that transaction. And the cases, I think, are clear, and they haven't presented any where the homestead interest owner should be able to dispossess the fee interest owner of, in this case, half the appraised value of the house, simply by structuring a transaction between, in this case, himself as executor and himself as the homestead interest owner. So
since this is a breach of fiduciary duty case, he breached his duty.
Absolutely, absolutely. Lucas versus Lucas is an important case. Justice Owen refers to it, and so I encourage you all to review that as well, and I'll submit the citation to the court in a letter brief afterwards, but we're in a letter to the court. But by application here, if for some reason Winton Terrace had been subject to a forced sale, Hollis Sloan would not be entitled to walk off with $222,000, with the remainder going to the estate. No, the entire proceeds, all $444,000, must be reinvested in a new homestead that Mr. Sloan would have the right to live in for as long as he wanted to or until he died. But then that entire homestead, all $444,000 of that new homestead, would pass in its entirety to the wife's estate upon his death or abandonment. Bottom line is that Mr. Sloan is not entitled to monetize his homestead interest, his possessory homestead interest, at the expense of the fee-holding estate, and certainly not when he's an executor of the estate.
But really, he's not trying to monetize his interest. He's trying to monetize her remainder interest, because that's the portion he's trying to buy or did buy, allegedly.
Well, that portion he actually transferred to her estate. So what he's saying...
Well, so he didn't even take it. He didn't...
He paid the $222,000. The other $222,000 he put into his own pocket and in the form of Winton Terrace.
Because
and
he treated it
part of his estate.
So he treated that half as his community.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And you know, I mean, you also have a stipulation on its community character. In other words, you say in 19 the parties agree that plaintiff has no evidence to overcome the presumption that the property was community. But that still is an issue on appeal?
The parties have, for purposes of appeal, as Mr. Disney pointed out, the issue for appeal, both the trial court decided that it was separate property.
Okay.
And it was not, and that issue has not been appealed.
Okay, so we're starting with the assumption that it is separate property.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So you take one of those good, fun issues away from us, huh?
There's nothing further.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Disney, your rebuttal.
I want to make sure we're understood. We are not claiming that a life estate is the same as a homestead. But the Rogers case is very instructive. The first issue is, remember, the facts are the same. The deceased spouse had separate property and owed taxes, left behind a spouse that had a homestead but no ownership interest other than the homestead in that property. So the facts are identical. First question is, does Texas law prohibit the IRS from taking enforcing the tax lien and selling the property? The answer is no. Okay, we don't have a forced sale issue. But they said, and then the IRS said, well, okay, we sell it, we get all the money. And the Supreme Court said, no, you don't, because the wife has an interest. You can only take the husband's interest. He's the taxpayer. And then it says, okay, that raises the question, how do we value the wife's interest? That's exactly what we have here.
But they say, and I'm looking at that opinion right now, the exact method for the distribution required is not before us at this time. But, for example, if we assume only for the sake of illustration, and then they go on and give this method that you've described earlier. So that's not a whole, that's dicta.
And you've made a good point. Cases since then in the tax context have used that analysis to determine the value of the homestead interest that limits the amount the IRS can take. I don't know any other way. I mean, we could send it back to Judge King and said, figure out how to value the homestead. What they're saying is, a homestead is real close to a life estate. The only difference is you can abandon a homestead. And then, if you read the case, it says, everybody understands there's no way to value the possibility of abandonment. So, that's the only logical way. The other approach, their approach is to say a homestead has zero value. And that can't possibly be right. So what is in the record to allow us to value? Yes, they said it's not really before us, but to give guidance to the courts afterwards. Here's a logical way to do it, and it frankly is about the only way to do it. Another point I want to make is Judge King really put the cart before the horse. He said 444, 222, you breathe. You've got to determine the value to see if you overpaid or underpaid. Unless and until you determine the value and then say he underpaid, there can't be a breach. So that's why I said this is a valuation case, has to come first.
And it seems like the parties kept talking about the date of death value. In other words, what was the value of Winton either at her death or at his death? But isn't it really the valuation at the time he purchased it?
And he did it within a year, as I recall.
Yeah, it was 2003. Okay.
Because he also used, he transferred 9 pieces of property into hers and used date of death value for those two. So that really is not
okay.
Something that's come up. The one last point I want to make is the Constitution says you have a homestead. And they're saying because you made a mistake, you're somehow not worthy of getting the benefits of the constitutionally protected homestead. And that just can't be right. I know this gets kind of complicated, but the only way to value the homestead is to use the life tables. Nobody's ever suggested anything else. They just say, well, that shouldn't apply. But maybe it's an open question, and maybe this court ought to be the one to say, when this comes up, the life tables are the only way to do it that has the effect of protecting the constitutionally given homestead right of the surviving spouse, because it probably has some value.
And who pays the real property taxes while the surviving spouse remains in the property?
You know, I'm not 100% sure.
I think it's in the probate code or estate code.
If we sold it to another third party who paid something less than 444, I don't think it's a dispossess. I think it's a you share possession. He gets part of the house, you get part of the house. That's not what happened here, but the focus should be we had a constitutionally protected homestead right that he had an interest in that property. He's only required to buy her interest in the property that he doesn't already own. What's the value of his interest? And I'm suggesting the life table is the only way to possibly come up with a number.
Well, and does the record include any valuation for at least maybe the rental value? Do we have anything? Okay. All right. Well, counsel, we appreciate all of your arguments and your briefing today. It's been very helpful to the court on this rather interesting, complex case. Yes.
May I have an opportunity to respond to that?
Yes, what we will do is allow the parties to file a post-submission letter brief. If you can provide yours with the additional sites, I believe you wanted to, within 10 days from today's date, and then Mr. Disney, you'd have another 10 days to respond, just by letter.
For clarification purposes, you want argument in that letter or just a site?
I think you just had a few cases you wanted to mention, is that correct?
Yeah. Two cases that were not included.
You can just recite the purpose of submitting those in summary fashion and vice versa. All right, thank you. Your case is submitted and you all are excused. We will proceed with case number 2 on our docket. Oh, we're going to take just a second here to work on some techno problems.